Yeah, welcome to this episode of Saintly Witnesses, where we speak to Catholics across social media who are out there doing great things. On this particular episode, I got Molly Quinn, who's going to come on and share a little bit about the ins and outs of being a librarian. And we're even going to get a little bit political and touch on some contemporary hot button issues that involve librarians. So thank you for coming on and giving us this crucial information.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Cool. So describe your faith journey. Tell us a little bit about some of the major parts. How was it growing up, middle life, and how you came where you are now?
So I grew up Catholic. I was a homeschool Catholic until I was in high school. That's when I went to public school. But my mom was Catholic my whole life. My dad converted when he was it was 2007 about that he converted. And I grew up with really empathetic parents who stressed the importance of Catholic teaching, specifically when it comes to like social justice and everything. That was my foundation for a lot of it all and everything. And then a couple of years ago, I kind of got a little downtrodden with the way that the Catholic Church can be, with like the history of the Catholic Church being in very colonial, a lot of colonial powers, a lot of racism within the Catholic Church, a lot of like the sex abuse crisis and stuff. And it kind of made me re-examine why exactly am I Catholic? And the answer was and always 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 was just because of Jesus and his mercy. Yes, it's great to have all the aesthetics of Catholicism, and if you know great clergy members, which I do, that's awesome. But ultimately, that type of stuff will fail you if you don't have the real foundation there, which is God, which is Jesus. And that was just something that I had to kind of come to terms with, and kind of realize it's like this idea in my head of like, hey, the Catholic Church is always, great at having, social justice, and this is what they teach and everything. It's like, well, not always, but we can always do better, and just relying on Jesus's mercy. And then also a couple of years ago, there was I kind of started more seriously practicing the practice of the philosophy of memento mori, which is Latin for remember your death. And there's kind of two ways to practice that philosophy. You can do it kind of in a more secular way, which is just kind of basically another way of saying like carpe diem or seize the day. What do you want to get out of life before you die? Take that trip to Europe or whatever it looks like. Make sure you spend time with your family, don't work so hard, that kind of stuff. But then there's also a religious way of looking at memento mori, which is more like you have to be prepared to meet God every day, either because you've died and you need to meet God that way, or because you're meeting God in your neighbor, and God's face is in your neighbor, and you need to be prepared to how are you going to talk to Jesus today and everything. So I think that I'm still within the practice of that. I haven't fully actualized what that looks like for me and everything, but I've been practicing that for the last couple of years, and that's really helped me in my faith journey, just knowing where what my next what I need to do to make my the next best step and everything. So
Thank you so much for sharing. I really appreciate that. So how did you discern the pathway to start working in a library?
I have always been a library kid. Since I was a baby, I was a library kid. And then when I was in high school, I worked as a library aide for my school library. And I have always loved libraries, but then weirdly, I never thought of libraries as a path for me until I was, a year out of college. My undergrad is in creative writing, so obviously there's not a like a specific pathway there except for like writer or teacher. And I didn't necessarily know, you know, I wasn't ever published or anything like that. So it was one of those things I was like, I don't know what I need to do here. So I was just kind of like floundering around. I was working as a preschool teacher at the time, which as much as I love the kids at the preschool and everything, it was definitely not my calling. It was just one of those things. And then it just kind of dawned on me. I was like, oh, I could be a librarian, and I could be a really good one at that too. So I applied to my library that I currently work at to be a page, and I worked my way up, and I now work in the youth and teen section of a public library. It's just exactly what I absolutely should be doing. It fits all of my interests and needs. Anytime that I want, you know, to explore something and think that there's, like want to try a different craft project and everything, I can just do that and, you know, do a craft with teens and everything. And it's just exactly the type of work that I really love being in. But it was kind of interesting that I never even thought of it as a possibility, not because I wouldn't have liked it always, but just because I never even thought of it until I was just kind of at a moment of like, oh, wait, that is exactly what I need to be doing right now.
Well, I'm glad you find bliss in your position, and yes, to work with like the youth and teen section of a library must have like a lot of interesting aspects to your job with like different personalities.
Yes.
Thank you for answering. Such a good answer. So my next question involves this. Many schools across the country are gotten rid of libraries and schools. I know, for instance, like in Houston last summer, the new superintendent in Houston ISD got rid of the libraries and made them into detention centers. So what do you think about this idea of removing libraries from schools? And why is that a problem?
You know, it's, I think people, it's coming from a place of ignorance, I think, for people, because people think that's like, oh, people have the internet, they have, access to these books. But it just shows like a really lack of understanding. It was like, well, not everyone has access to the internet. Not everyone has access to the books and the databases that libraries provide, because they don't have just the resources to have access to that. And so I think sometimes it's coming from a place of ignorance of just like, we don't need libraries because this is, we've kind of outgrown the need for a physical space. But the reality is a physical space is something that is so needed for so many people. It's a sense of community that you have. It's, you know, like you're not kind of bound by, kind of like an algorithm telling you what books you should read or whatever. You're able to kind of like discover new reads kind of in a more organic way, either by asking the librarian for book recommendations or just by browsing the shelves. That gives you the ability to empathize with people through literature. And I think so sometimes I think it's ignorance that people do that, but I think also it ultimately comes down to this kind of like anti-intellectual movement that we've been going towards. People don't want people really thinking about stuff. They don't want people caring about stuff. And just by the nature of being a library, if you're in a library, you do care about stuff. If you're in a library, you do think about stuff because you're thinking about which book to read, even if it's as simple as that. And you're surrounded by your community members. So it's really disheartening for me to see so many people remove school libraries, because school libraries in particular are so needed. I don't work in a school library. I work in a public library, but they're so needed because not everyone can come to the public library because it's very dependent, especially if you live in a car-centric city like I do, where you really can't live without a car in most American cities. It's really difficult for a lot of kids to make it to the library because they don't have like a ride there all the time because their parents are working or whatever. So the only access to the library that they have is through their school. So it's very disheartening to see people devalue that level of intellectualism, community, and just kind of like overall, like just gaining empathy, to exactly, as you said, kind of like make it into like a detention center and everything. It's just like, just what a way to just devalue and, you know, dehumanize people. And it's just something that sometimes I think it's like I said, it's ignorance, but a lot of times I think it's also just like hatefulness and cruelty that also drives some of this stuff. So it's a little disheartening to see that. I wish people would feel, you know, have more pride, have more awareness of how important libraries actually are.
I like what you said a lot, because libraries are such an invaluable resource for community information. And they even play a key role in getting people resources that they need, like business information, nonprofit help, tax help, and even serve as a shelter for the unhoused. So that's real good. Librarians are probably one of the most undervalued and depreciated careers in schools and in the community. How can we start moving towards better valuing this crucial career?
Oh, wow. I think the first thing is there needs to be more money going to both schools and to libraries. And there needs to be more of an emphasis on education and intellectualism and just the pursuits of intellectualism. And just, I think ideally it would be not politicians making the final say on a lot of the what we see, you know, like in Arkansas where I am, we have our governor has you know, just put out you know, the Learns Act, which is basically a an act that prevents there's a whole lot of things that it covers, but one of the things that it covers is it prevents teachers from talking about critical race theory in the classroom and everything, which is, you know, I guarantee if you try to like talk to Governor Sanders and say like describe critical race theory to me, like what is it actually, like she wouldn't be able to answer it in a way that most people who actually study critical race theory would accept as a like an actual definition. And so ideally I think it would be the educators and the people who are actually interested in intellectualism who would be making the rules when it comes to this kind of stuff, and not, you know, politicians, because unfortunately, and this is just true for a lot of people, but particular people in politics, there's a very short-sighted you know, idea of what you know, success looks like. So really, you know, if we started implementing more, you know, better education, better funded education, better you know, funded intellectual pursuits and everything, we wouldn't see immediately the fruits of our labor. It would be 20 years from now, we would see a lot of people being way more, you know, able to critically think and everything. But then people wouldn't be thinking like this is directly tied to that, even though it is, so because we're very short-sighted people. You know, like I think of stuff like in preschools, as an example, again, I have like backgrounds in preschool, as a preschool teacher. You know, a lot of politicians see that's like, hey, we want to get reading scores up. So they start taking away kind of playtime activities for younger kids in kindergarten, preschool. And they start kind of implementing kind of more like reading activities. And I love reading. I think it's great. But the reality is, if we don't give those playtimes to kids, they're not developing that side of the brain that actually can help them read and write and, you know, like be stronger, like with motor skills and everything. And we don't think about how these things are related. But the people that actually study this, the educators, the librarians, they do think about this. So if we were to kind of change the world to be more welcoming to intellectual pursuits, we would be highlighting the people that actually know what they're talking about and following their lead. And we would be giving a lot more money to community centers, like schools, like libraries, rec centers, whatever, and a lot less money. This is maybe controversial, but a lot less money to organizations like the police, which are a solution to a problem that doesn't need to be a problem, I guess, if we were to actually put in resources to helping people better themselves and everything. So it's one of those things that it just would kind of require, you know, restructuring of how we do our taxes, I think, giving more money to community centers and taxing people who are in the 1%, so that we're getting more money in general. And then I think that we would be in a lot better of a position if that was where we were heading and everything. So
okay, that's a really good answer. So over the last couple of years, we've been seeing a rise of banning controversial books in GOP-led states. What do you think about this? And you even touched on this because of your own state of Arkansas. What do you think about this, and how is this a threat to literacy for young adults?
Yeah, that is, it's interesting to see how these book challenges and book bans have shifted and changed just over the, you know, I've been in libraries for the last 6 years. Over the last 6 years, it's changed significantly, because it used to be an individual parent would come in with an individual complaint of one particular book, maybe a handful of books, but it was, you know, it was like one parent who was doing this. And now it's like one parent who's coming in and complaining about all of the books. And then not only wanting all of these books removed from the shelves, they want to criminalize the librarians for providing these books. And it's one of those things, and we've seen this type of law just in so many different places. Arkansas was one of the places we had. We have Act 372. My library is currently fighting Act 372 right now, which basically that's a law that would criminalize librarians and booksellers for providing books that are deemed obscene. You know, never once in a million years when I first started librarianship did I think that I would be in a position where I would be potentially arrested for doing my job. Like, that never even crossed my mind. And then I actually had to have like some real tough conversations with my family and everything. It was like, if I'm arrested, which is a possibility now, this is what I want you to do. This is, you know, how I want you to get the word out and all this kind of stuff. Which is just wild that we're in this position. Luckily, that particular law is actually not in effect yet in Arkansas. It's been like held off until it's deemed constitutional. So hopefully it never goes into effect. When I look at how this will affect literacy, what I see even now is a lot of people just kind of afraid to kind of speak their authentic truth and read about books because they're worried it will be, or like read about certain topics in books because they're worried it will be, you know, controversial. They're kind of self-censoring with this kind of stuff. I see that especially in I'm not like blaming the teachers for doing this, but I'm seeing that especially in teaching, just because they're worried that they're going to be, like criminalized in some ways. And it's really difficult. And a lot of, you know, public librarians, I see a lot of them like quietly removing books from the shelf that they feel like will be controversial and everything. And obviously I have a big problem with that, because my thing is, you know, you don't put that much emphasis on the people who are complaining about this kind of stuff. We know that though they don't speak for the whole community. We know that that's not what's going on and everything. We need to educate instead of removing certain books and everything. But I think that there's a real possibility of just kind of a, like, it sounds doomsayer, you know, to say and everything, but just a real possibility of just kind of like a complete lack of intellectual pursuit of critical thinking skills being the result of something like this, because I just see so many people just advocating for censorship, advocating for this, even if they agree with me on like most issues, because they don't either want to get in trouble, or, you know, sometimes you see people like they don't want to trigger other people with certain topics and everything. I'm like, you gotta let people make their own decision and what they read. Like, that's It is the end, you know, the long and short of it. You can't decide what other people read because you find it distasteful. And so it's interesting to see how there's just a growing intellectual anti-intellectual movement, and it's resulted in a lot of like critical thinking skills being not as present as you would hope that they would be. And that will only get worse, I think, if we don't disrupt the censorship fanatics from taking over.
My last question involved the literary canon. I remember when I was my last year teaching in the classroom, we had this really lively debate about the canon in English and how to approach it going forward. I really felt like it was a good opportunity to talk about something that we never really addressed in curriculum when we read these unit texts. So what is a literary canon and why is it controversial? And what do you think about this topic?
Oh gosh, this is a good question. I love this type of question. I could probably talk about it for hours and hours because I think it's so fascinating. How I understand it, the literary canon is just kind of like really important books that are, you know, classic books that are something that we, you know, either talk about a lot in pop culture or, you know, that kind of stuff, and that we feel like every, you know, should be a foundation for people, for their educational movement, you know, just education in general. And the reason why a lot of, you know, the literary canon is controversial is because a lot of the people who are introduced into the canon are, until very, very recently, tended to be white straight men. And so you had like Mark Twain, William Shakespeare, and Ulysses, James Joyce. I mean, James Joyce, Homer. All these people were part of the literary canon. This is, you know, they wrote some great stuff. It's not that they didn't, but it's like they, in addition to, you know, them. You know, Toni Morrison wasn't alongside them, and I'm blanking on every author's name, but like Gabriel Marquez wasn't alongside them and everything. So it just kind of became suddenly, you know, like we're teaching Jane Austen, but we're not teaching Toni Morrison. So how, you know, like that obviously is like framing a very specific, you know, colonial thought, that is, and we're not like talking about other people, and other people's experience and how, you know, like that's incredibly important. And so my thought of the literary canon is I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to have, educators and people who are interested in intellectualism decide what is like a really good piece of you know, literature and everything. I think that it only becomes a problem when we don't open it up to like authentic kind of like great pieces of artwork because of different biases that we have. A great example of that, one of my favorite examples, is Octavia Butler was kind of excluded from the literary canon for years because she was she's a Black woman, and she was also writing science fiction stories, so it was a genre and everything. But when you read her work, it's like it's so much more than just kind of like, you know, some corny science fiction story. You know, Kindred is just incredible. It's so amazing, and absolutely should be taught in schools, in universities and everything, and absolutely should be taught. So she's recently kind of been included into the canon, but she was excluded because of her race, because of her gender, and because of the genre of stuff that she was writing. So if I think it's good to have a literary canon in the sense that I think it's good to have intellectuals and academics kind of talk about what they think is the most important books that are written in a particular time period. I think that that is a really good thing to have. I don't think it's good when we exclude just so many people because of biases and everything. Unfortunately, that happens quite a bit with the literary canon. So there's a long way to go of kind of correcting that. And it starts from very, you know, very young age, in, you know, grades K through 12, of just like kind of acknowledging that's like, hey, we need to have a more diverse awareness of what we are reading and not just focus on, you know, Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, all the time. Not, you know, not to say that that's a bad book or that we shouldn't read it, but it's just, we also need to be reading some other books, written by people who have experienced certain, perspectives, and, just allowing people to realize that literature also is about learning to grow, learning to either see ourselves, in it, but also see other people. And if a certain group of people aren't being represented in the canon, then that's a problem. So,
yeah, it sounds like, you know, it's about redistribution, redistributing some of their literary power to other voices who have just equally valid and better experiences or equal experiences. It's not about redistributing that power. So I would agree with that. I appreciate your approach. And I think what you said really makes a lot of sense. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing this crucial information about what it means to be a librarian and even a little bit of your thoughts on like these contemporary issues. May the listeners pray for you and the work that you do. And I thank you for coming on. And you can listen to this next episode of Saintly Witnesses.